This is Barbara Glickstein, and you're tuned into Health Styles, brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. You can find out more about us at centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. My first guest is Dr. Sue Ellen Miller. She's the Director of Safe Motherhood Programs and a professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the Bigsby Center for Global Reproductive Health and Policy, University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Sue Ellen Miller is a globally recognized expert in international maternal health. She founded the Safe Motherhood Program in 2003 and has pioneered the studies of the non-pneumatic anti-shock garment, a first aid device used to stabilize women who are suffering from obstetric hemorrhage and shock. She's also known globally as the Life Wrap Igniter. Welcome to Health Styles, Dr. Miller.
Thank you so much, Barbara. It's really a pleasure to be able to meet with you and speak to your audience.
We often hear about innovation and ways that devices change people's lives. And I must say that the Life Wrap Igniter and the stories that I've read about your work and about the work of people in your communities who are advancing the use of this are really incredible. I know you're a nurse midwife, and I know that you have practiced as a nurse midwife for a number of years. And in a TED Talk that I watched that featured you, you talked about at one point in your practice, you noted a huge discrepancy of care for women around the world. Although you had been practicing in the United States, your travels globally began to show you a huge discrepancy. You referred to it as related to a gross gender and social inequality and a violation of human rights. Will you speak to that?
Yes, absolutely, and thank you so much for asking. I was a part of a women's health movement that began in the 60s and 70s in the U.S. and was very active in a natural mother-led childbirth movement here in California, and where I've been practicing. And so my colleagues and I, other nurse midwives and I, and some physicians, really had dedicated ourselves to helping women achieve their idea of the best possible birth experience. And I lived in a community and was able to see women growing as families with their new babies and then subsequent children. And it was pretty ideal. I knew that it wasn't like that in a lot of other places in the U.S., but I had no idea until I took a trip to Nepal with my own 10-year-old daughter and was in a hospital where I'd been invited to come and saw women giving birth in the most unbelievable conditions. Women came in. There was only one bed that many women were sharing. There were no sheets for the bed. And then, after witnessing some very sad births, was invited by one of the doctors to come to their private hospital. And while the resources in that private hospital were not up to the standards that I had been used to in the University of California, San Francisco, the way the women were treated was so different. So it was possible for me to see just in that one setting the difference of economics, the difference of class, and then, of course, the difference between a low-resource developing country setting and the setting that I had come from. So that was really what got me started on my life in international health.
So you returned back to the States and continued to be a midwife, but began to look at some of the ways that, as a midwife and as a nurse researcher, you could make an impact. When did this innovation of the Life Wrap happen, and what was that spark that you were a part of and helped to move forward?
Well, the trip that I took to Nepal, that first, sort of my first international trip, was in 1987. And I started at that point continuing to do my midwifery practice, but also trying to take 2 to 3 consultancies per year going to a lower resource setting and being able to start training and teaching. So that continued for quite some time until the idea and the development of the Life Wrap took place in 2002. So it was quite a big gap of time between my first experience and when I was able to finally look at being able to affect some change. It was pretty disappointing working in maternal health during that long period of time, almost two decades, of really no change in maternal mortality ratios across the globe. They continued at a very high level. The same things that I described when I first saw the first birth that I saw in Nepal continued to happen elsewhere. Policies were not being implemented. The answer seemed to be, yes, social and economic disparities, so yes, we need roads and we need hospitals and we need more training for skilled attendants. These are all things that need to be done. Those are long-term solutions that require a lot of political will and a lot of advocacy. So those things had started to take place, but had not taken place in 2002. And someone, I don't know, do you want the whole Life Wrap story here?
I think it's an important story, please.
Okay. So if you can sort of picture a community of safe motherhood advocates and practitioners globally, people being pretty downtrodden in their feelings about, are we going to be able to make any change, affect any difference? Women are still dying, poor women especially, and what is it that we can do? And a colleague of mine who knew a female astronaut, I'm sorry that I have to say female astronaut, but
one day we won't have to.
Yes, right. But this had told her about this device that had been developed by NASA and that it was an improvement on a previous garment that had been used to keep pilots from fainting at high altitude, but it also worked for transporting people with injuries below the diaphragm as far back as during the Vietnam War. And she said she'd heard of one person who had used this non-pneumatic anti-shock garment in a hospital in Pakistan that didn't have a blood bank, and that this person had written about those few cases where he'd used this device. And so I contacted him because he happened to be OBGYN at Stanford, which is quite close to where I was. And his name was Paul Hensley. And we got together and started talking. And he described the device to me and then brought the device to me. And we looked at it and thought about how we could use it, really use it, in low-resource settings where there were long delays in acquiring the kind of care that a woman needs to save her life when she has obstetric hemorrhage. So we took the device, we went to the MacArthur Foundation and approached them to see if we could get a small amount of funding to do a pilot study. And we were successful in obtaining the funding, and people thought it was a great idea, but we needed to do the clinical trials that would demonstrate and document that it did indeed save lives. So that's how we got it started.
So that's over 20 years ago now?
No, 2002.
Oh, I'm sorry, 2002.
Yeah.
I got stuck in the 80s.
Yeah, I know, me too.
That's not unusual.
No, either.
And for our listeners to understand this focus on trying to stabilize women who are suffering from obstetric hemorrhage and the role of the Life Wrap, can you simply describe that?
Yes, I'll try. Obstetric hemorrhage is the number one killer of women in childbirth. And as we have seen, the incidence, this is sort of the global incidence of bleeding heavily after childbirth, is the same everywhere. So many of your listeners may have themselves bled following delivery or know someone who bled following delivery, and it's scary, but generally it can be stopped in a well-equipped hospital that has skilled staff. It can be stopped with medication, can be stopped by skilled hands or could be treated eventually with surgery. The other thing that if someone gets into a lot of trouble, they need a blood transfusion. None of those treatments are available if a woman is delivering at home in a hut with a friend or her mother or mother-in-law who has no skills and no access to drugs and medications. So she would need to be transported, and the transport itself could take hours to days, and obstetric hemorrhage can kill in less than 2 hours. So a woman can bleed to death very rapidly. The anti-shock garment is a compression device. So it's not a treatment like a blood transfusion or surgery. It's neoprene and Velcro, kind of looks like the bottom of a wetsuit, mm-hmm. but it closes with Velcro. So it's segments of neoprene that are open. You wrap them tightly around the lower half of a woman. It closes tightly with Velcro, and that very simple device is adequate to provide enough compression on the blood vessels going into the lower part of the body to reverse shock that's happened and to decrease the bleeding enough so that at least in the work that we have done, we've been able to decrease mortality by 50%.
Wow. So
yeah.
How have you gotten the life wrap into the hands of people who can help that woman laboring, delivered, and having obstetric hemorrhage in that hut in some small village? Give us that scenario.
Well, that depends on making connections with the people who are in countries who are working with women and working with community organizations, working with the public health system. So a lot of that has been through NGOs, through ministers of health who might attend a meeting where we are presenting, who invite us to come to the country. So we play a role that's much of a dissemination role and advocacy and information role. And then if we're invited to a place, we'll then find out who's the most in touch with women, work with those people. Within that group, there are usually strong influencers, people who have a lot of authority with and or they're looked up to. And if they advocate for this device, then it can usually get down to the hands of the frontline healthcare workers, the community grassroots workers who can get it to women.
And since this has been developed and it has been disseminated to those wonderful hands of both the important influences and communities to be available, so there might be one available in a certain area that can be reused and transported fairly quickly if there's communication access to let that person who holds the device know it's needed in that particular area of that village?
Right. There's a number of ways, and it really depends on the context. Who's passing through that village? Is the village on the road to a facility? Is it close to a facility? How far it might be? Whether the device is, let's say, in the head chief's hut or in his wife's area, they might keep it there. In the telephone kiosk, you know, there are different places where people meet. So at the lowest level, it would be there. If there's a telephone and cell phone penetration is quite deep now in many places, if there's a cell phone transport system that a community has developed, then it might be at the place where the transport is. So an easy, relatively easy way of getting an anti-shock garment to a woman in need would be on an ambulance, whether that's a bicycle ambulance or a motorcycle sidecar ambulance or some way that the woman can then be transported. So it might be put in a midwife's hands or it might be in the transporter's hands or it might be as far away as the first level healthcare, which would be a primary healthcare hut in some villages and some systems. And yes, the device, once it's on the woman, stays on the woman until she is stabilized and treated, and then it can be removed and it can be disinfected and washed and then reused around 70 times.
And I know that you have just returned from one of your extensive trips around the world, and for a very exciting reason. When the device was first designed, what was the price for the development of one of these devices?
Well, the first devices that we used, and we used them in our clinical trials, we paid around $170 per garment. And at the time, we were able to sort of figure out, thanks to colleagues in different countries, that the number of times it could be reused was around 40 or 50. Since that time, we have worked with organizations such as PATH, the Program for Applied Technology in Health, and with a manufacturer, the Blue Fusion Group in Hong Kong, to replicate the same device that we were paying $170 for so that it could be produced at quality with good manufacturing and good labor practices for about $60 to $70 per garment. So the price per garment has come way down, and through other testing that we did and new disinfection procedures, we now can launder and reuse them around 70 times.
That's fantastic news. I'm thrilled to hear that.
It's pretty incredible, because then you present to someone like a Ministry of Health and Finance, because the finance people have to be involved, of saving a woman's life for less than a dollar.
Well, let's talk about some of the politics. I know we began this conversation where you have spoken to the issue of gender inequality and social inequality and resource inequality. The idea that this device now would be available shortly because of the Blue Fusion Group and the incredible work by you and others involved in this work have reduced the cost now to $60 and it's reusable 70 times. How has the political issues of women's rights and women's role in society, and I know that's a big question in every place, it's different, and including in our own country, made this argument difficult and not based on securing and saving a woman's life for a dollar?
Well, there has been a change over time of at least people paying attention to women's lives. And this was largely due to the Millennium Development Goals. To make a goal of reducing maternal mortality by 75% from 2000 to 2015 was a really big leap, as many of the Millennium Development Goals were. And I have to say myself, I was very skeptical to hear that goal and think, well, that's never going to happen. This is Millennium Development Goal 5. And it hasn't happened. The majority of countries have not reduced maternal mortality by 15%, by 75%. And some countries, the maternal mortality ratio has actually increased. But it brought women's lives mattering into the conversation, which up to that point, it had not. And their role as the vessel and carrier of the baby had sometimes been emphasized, but not the value of the woman's life itself. And I think that has been that way from forever, as far as I can tell in my career as a midwife. So I believe there's been some modification of that, if only countries now have to come to some agreement. So the advocacy language and the language at the ministry level has changed. And if you attend a meeting in a country, in the Philippines, in Indonesia, in Timor-Leste, in Africa, almost always now people are saying, we cannot let mothers die. And that has made the introduction of this device much easier. Although I have to say that wasn't easy since it's been 12 years of trying to get it going, but much easier when you have that talk, that speech, that verbiage, or that hook at least to say, okay, if you're interested in saving women's lives, here's the device that can help. You still need infrastructure. There needs to be a hospital that women can go to. There has to be skilled providers. Women have to be educated. Families have to be educated on what the risks are, what the signs are. And, you know, global girls' education is what it's going to take to get there. But there is a way now to at least insert something like this into the conversation, and people can say, oh, yeah, this is an important thing. So it's been an incredible change
over
my career.
I imagine. I'm thinking about your one-on-one encounters as you travel around the world, teaching other midwives, teaching other nurses, teaching community health workers, teaching tribal chiefs and elders who are the educators in places that you have brought this device. I imagine those moments of great awe and inspiration for them to have something that will save women's lives has had a tremendous impact on your drive and your passion to keep doing this work.
Well, it's really what keeps me going. You know, you wake up in the morning and you read the newspaper and you see that the U.S., you know, the number of women dying in childbirth is increasing. Lack of access to health care, lack of education, lack of insurance, although hopefully that's changing somewhat. And, you know, decreasing standards within public hospitals because of revenue problems. So to go to a village somewhere, usually with a colleague, definitely with colleagues, but usually with a colleague who can do some interpretation for me, and to talk to midwives who have women die in their hands, and then to introduce this garment, to train them. It takes a couple of hours to do the training, and to be privileged enough in my own life to be able to hang around and see it be used. And to see what happens to women who are the providers, the midwives and nurses, who generally are the ones who stand by helplessly when a woman dies, be able to save a life with something so simple. And it is. It's truly empowering for me to be able to continue to do the work.
So you recently came back from this 6 weeks, was it, of traveling?
Yeah, 6 weeks.
6 weeks. Where are you off to next, and what's in the future for LifeWrap?
I'm not really sure where my next trip is going to be, besides going to the East Coast to see my grandbabies. But I'm working on three projects right now. One is in Timor-Leste, as I said, where I already visited, and Tanzania. So I'll be doing the follow-up work there, see what happens after 6 months after training and how implementation is going. I'm also working on a project in Uganda, which is really following women with fistula, another obstetric complication, after fistula repair to see how their lives are impacted after they have their fistula repaired. So those are where I'm probably going in the first half of next year.
And you informed us and educated us that obstetric hemorrhage is the number one cause of death of women in childbirth. What are the others, and are there devices and innovation that's part of what you're thinking about in the future of what's next?
Yes, the second killer, and there's sort of two, and they take turns in different places, is eclampsia, preeclampsia, a disease that's related to hypertension of pregnancy. And there is a very simple and easy treatment for that, which is magnesium sulfate. It's an old treatment, but now people are beginning to realize that it can be administered at lower levels of the healthcare system, that it can be packaged in a way that's easier for healthcare workers to understand. And I'm also really privileged right now to be working with a group called PREEMPT, which is from British Columbia, and specifically a group at the King's College London, who are working on a device, a very simple traffic light system device that will alert unskilled healthcare workers. It's wrapped around like a blood pressure cuff and inflated, but it just signals this is a problematic blood pressure that would then signal a healthcare worker that a woman would need either the mag sulfate or transport. The piece I'm adding to that is actually looking at shock and that it being a way of telling if a woman is about to go into shock and not having to wait for her to go unconscious, which is too late for someone who doesn't have skills to read a blood pressure to alert them to the woman being at risk.
Wow. Do you know about the Make a Nurse Project here in the United States?
I don't.
Well, the Make a Nurse Project is funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and two wonderful engineer, innovative, tech savvy folks at MIT Lab, at the MIT Media Lab, have a great story. I'll be brief because it just reminds me and aligns with the innovation that you're sharing with us now. One of the two people on this project had lived abroad in on the continent of Africa and saw how health nurses were innovating when there wasn't something they would have if the resources were there. And it made them realize that that must be happening here in the U.S. And they came back, and with support from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, they're traveling around the country and identifying nurses who are fabricating solutions to challenges on the front lines of care here every day. So like you, there are other people in our healthcare community and nurses specifically we can talk about who are innovating, who are responding to the needs globally of people, who with some innovation and funds and attention to the issue are making such a difference. So I'm going to refer to you also as a maker nurse, Dr. Sue Ellen Miller.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm privileged to be among those
it's
makers.
It's part of that DIY, the do-it-yourself mentality, which I think healthcare people in the healthcare field and others, of course, will often figure out how to adapt something to make a patient safer, more comfortable, and in your case, with the community of people that you've been working with, save their life. So I hope to have you back on in the future to keep us updated. My guest has been Dr. Sue Ellen Miller. She's the director of the Safe Motherhood Programs and a professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Reproductive Sciences at the Bigsby Center for Global Reproductive Health and Policy at the University of California, San Francisco. I'm going to let you have the final say because there's so much we've learned from you today, and I wanted to give you a moment to let people know how they can find out more about the program, maybe support it, and help more life wraps be available globally in those towns, villages, and communities that can save women's lives.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Of course, I have a website, and it's www.safemotherhood.ucsf.edu. all together. And yes, you can donate. The donation goes to the University of California, San Francisco, but the button is to the Safe Motherhood Program. And we do have a program of honoring a woman, either your own mother or another woman, and donating a life wrap to a village. And it's a way of being able to participate, to not just hear about this and think, oh, I would love to be able to do something, but obviously you can't go with me to a village, but you could donate and honor a woman and make a big difference in someone's life.
I'll repeat that for our listeners. That's www.safemotherhood.ucsf.edu. I want to thank you, Dr. Sue Ellen Miller, for joining me today and taking time out of your schedule and for the incredible work that you're doing in the world. It's really been an honor and a pleasure to have this conversation with you.
Equally, Barbara, this was great. Thank you so much. And keep doing what you're doing. It's really important.
Thank you.